Welcome to the Confession Box. I'm Gary O'Sullivan. If you are a parent, today's podcast will interest you. What do you say to your young child when they come home, as they do in my house, from school and ask, Daddy, Mammy, what's the closest planet to heaven? Or do people who die become angels? To help answer how to deal with these questions as parents or teachers, we are delighted to be joined today by Julianne Stance, an Irish-American living in Los Angeles, who is an internationally known ministry leader and speaker. She's an author and director for Outreach for Evangelization and Discipleship with Loyola Press. And most importantly, she's a mom. Julianne has authored a book, The Catholic Parent Survival Guide, Straight Answers to Your Kids' Toughest Questions. Julianne, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. And hello to everybody who's listening in today. It's great to be here.
Thanks a million. Julianne, what did you say when your son asked you what's the closest planet to heaven? I have to say it would have me stumped.
Yeah, kids ask really hard questions at times. Yeah, we know that. And often at the most unexpected times when you're not prepared at all. And when my youngest Sean asked me, you know, what's the closest planet to heaven? I actually said to him, you know, because that's a good question, Sean, Mammy needs to think about it for a few minutes. And then I ended up going back to him and saying, I don't have a great answer for you right now. Can you give me a bit more time? I was stalling because I really wanted to give him. He's very scientifically minded. He was only 7 or 8 at the time when he asked it. But it was such an important question, and I knew he was really inquiring. And so I was thinking about it. And one day I was in a meeting anyway, and we were discussing kind of the life in the church and all different things in the world. And somebody asked somebody a question that was very similar, and I was listening for the answer. And I thought, simplicity is definitely the way to go. We can't be talking about angels dancing on the head of a pin. And I came back to him and I said, because your question is so important, Sean, Mammy needed a few extra days to think about it. But the closest planet to heaven is Earth. And he said, why? And I said, because this is the place where Jesus lived and walked. And so because we're trying to follow in his footsteps, Earth is the place that we're trying to follow him most closely. And he looked at me and he said, well, that makes sense. And I was relieved, but it was a real revelation for me that I have advanced degrees in theology and have studied, lots of religious topics for years, but I was struggling as a parent to address my own kids' questions about faith. And I realized that is probably true for many parents. And I turned to my husband and I said after this, what's it like for you with no, you know, religious education, no formation when the kids ask you these questions? And he said, I'm really struggling, Julianne. I wish somebody would write a book that would help us. And that's where the book started, was in the real conversations that I was having with my own children.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said struggling, because also you called the book The Catholic Parent Survival Guide.
Yeah.
It's a strong word, survival, but it is what parents feel, isn't it? They feel, like you say, an advanced degree in theology, but
yeah.
My little fella the other day asked me, Daddy, will we be able to look down when we're in heaven? Will we actually see things? Another day he asked me, will we still have our bodies and all this kind of thing?
Yeah.
The first answer comes to your mind is like, well, talk to your teacher.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I've realized like these conversations, I'll tell you, I did a lot of research for the book, and it was important to me to talk to real parents. So it's not just all my wisdom. Like I wanted to hear from parents like you, Gary, and what were the kind of questions your own kids were asking. But then I also went out and I interviewed close to 50 teenagers and kids from all different ages. And what I found was actually quite heartbreaking. A lot of the, you know, 13, 14 year olds were telling me they weren't asking their kids, their parents questions anymore. And when I asked them why, they said it's because the parents didn't know the answers. And so they stopped asking. And so I think the conversation is really important. And so parents will often say, you know, I just feel like I'm overwhelmed. Life is moving so fast. They've got, you know, sports and music practice and all the things that are going on. And then these questions come and I'm tired and I don't have the energy to think about them. I do think we're trying to survive in a culture sometimes. And then I think also, you know, when you have these conversations with your kids, even if they're difficult and you don't have perfect answers, it allows you to ask your children how they would answer that question. So one of the tips I give parents a lot is when you're asked a difficult question by a child or you know, your teenager, to turn around and say, tell me what you think. There's a couple of reasons for it. One, it allows you to check for why they're asking the question, which is often more important, because kids can Google the answers to the questions today, but what they can't Google is why you believe what you believe. And that's really what they're listening for. And then the second thing is, kids come into questions with a lot of prior experience and their own thoughts. And I think it's really important for us as parents to listen to them. And so I would love to know how you answered those questions too, you know? And, you know, it's the dialogue and it's the conversation that's really important.
And I suppose a lot of parents probably, Julianne, mightn't have very strong faith either. I don't know about in America, but in Ireland, we all kind of grew up with pretty poor catechesis. And I suppose our faith would be very childlike in many ways, you know, the old man in the sky kind of thing. And so maybe a lot of parents would feel, I don't know the answer. And even if I do technically know the answer, maybe I'm not so sure I believe it. Did you come across much of that?
I did, actually. And that's where I think there is a lot of similarities. I know, you know, Ireland and America are very, very different. The Irish American community actually has similar experiences around faith. So, you know, there are certain things that we do in Ireland that still connote faith to us in terms of, you know, Christmas and things. You know, we do put, like, you know, the candle in the window, things like that. Irish immigrants try to resurrect some of those traditions, even if they're not sure why they're important, to kind of keep their own cultural identity. And as I was talking to many of the parents over here, they were very honest with me and saying, you know, I didn't learn any of this stuff in school and I'm not sure I really believe in it. And so I'm afraid, like, I want my child to have a faith life. I want them to believe in God, but I struggle with that. And I think there's an honesty in that as well. Like, one of the things I say in the book is that I don't want this book to be for parents who are a certain way. You know, the families that are represented in the book are from lots of different demographics. They're from rural America. They're from cities. They're from single parent families. They're from families that look very, very different than mommy, daddy, and two children, right? And so I would say to parents, one of the things that you have to ask yourself is how important faith is to you. And if you want your child to have faith, what kind of faith do you want them to have? You know, is it a faith in a person, you know, the person of Jesus? Do you want them to understand that God created them because he loves them and that our faith is merciful and loving? I mean, really think about those core values. And that can be hugely helpful, in especially when it comes to the teenage years, in navigating some really difficult conversations with your kids.
Right. Okay. Julianne, another part of the work you do is you go around the country a lot with diocesan directors and you give talks more than retreats, I suppose, is it? And what do you find when you speak to these guys, the priests, the diocesan directors? What's their approach with young people? Do they engage or?
Yeah, you know, this is a great question. The US is what they call a highly intensely religious marketplace. What does that mean? There's religion, there's churches on every corner, right? And there's bars. I'm thinking about Wisconsin, for example. There's bars on every corner, there's churches on every corner. They're all different denominations. You can find, you know, very, very different styles of Catholicism in this country. So, for example, when I go down south to the southern states, and go to the Black community, there's, you know, hugely influenced gospel music. It's like, praise him. It's like exactly what you think it would be. It's very, very engaging and upbeat and it's very enjoyable. Out in California, for example, Mass is celebrated in close to 30 languages on a weekend. And all of those communities look very, very different. So when you go to a Hispanic community, the Mass music is very different. People are very, very dressed up many times. There's children running around. They're okay with sounds and wiggles and giggles. One of the unique parts of my job and has been for the last 20 years is I get to be in the rooms with bishops and cardinals and priests and seminarians. I also get to go out and talk to mammies and daddies. Like, I have everything in between. So I work with diocesan directors. I work with priests. I do lead retreats as well. And what I see across all the different people that I talk to is this kind of search for meaning and a hunger for, there has to be more to life. Life is moving so fast. It's so rushed. Mental health rates are skyrocketing. Issues with addiction and drug usage, all of that, right, is colliding in lots of different ways in homes. And people are looking for a sense of joy, a sense of peace, a sense of hope. And so I think we're no different in Ireland, right? We're all searching. And so what I do think is interesting about the conversation here is there's some real dialogue by the churches, at least from what I see in America, around how can we be at the forefront of issues like the housing crisis. Something as simple as like a lot of our parishes in the US have open rectories. They're starting to lease those to elderly communities, so the elderly can have assisted living communities, or in my locality, a lot of young adults who can't afford to get on the property market are living in community with each other in former rectories, and then they're doing acts of service, or they're teaching in the parish, or maybe they're doing Make a Difference Day with the kids. Like there's some in-kind opportunities there. So I think creativity and innovation is becoming more normative over in the US because there's so many options for faith over here. And I think in Ireland, I think Irish people have a strong and deep connection to their history and their landscape. And I just hope that they never lose that, because when you go back to Ireland, when I go home, actually I'm going home in a week, just seeing the monastic communities, the abbeys, the ruins, to me, they shouldn't be ruins, but they should be looked at as a living legacy for us to build upon for the future.
Right. That's interesting what you say about the young people living in community in the rectories, because we had a young journalist here who's gone down to Cork now. He can't afford to live in Dublin. And he was saying, you know, every time a bishop comes out and talks about migrants and talks about asylum seekers, nothing against these people coming in trying to make a new life here. But he says you never hear the bishops talking about young Catholics who need homes to for their families to start their lives, you know, and maybe parishes should look at those kind of things.
Absolutely. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples that I'm thinking about over here that, and I'm not like, I go to communities where there's 3,000 people at Mass, but my own parish is 150, right? It's a very, very small, little local Catholic church. There's different things that they do. Like they coordinate food drives for the elderly. They, you know, we will have concerts in our parish community, and we'll do outreach. We have masses that are what we call young adult friendly, where, you know, maybe the music is a little different. Some communities, it's very upbeat and contemporary. Other young adult communities like something that's a bit more elevated and classical. And there's room for both. But I am seeing the Catholic Church in America galvanized to look at real needs and real issues. I know one bishop, for example, he started a house for women who were the victims of human trafficking. And I just think that's such a beautiful reflection. I know one bishop who moved out of the what was called the Bishop's Palace, and I know we have those in Ireland too. And he moved out of it. He took a little small house, little bungalow for himself, and the whole house was turned into a home for women fleeing domestic violence and men who are fleeing domestic violence. So I think we have an opportunity to look at how the church can intersect with real people's lives today. That's where I'd love to see the Catholic Church in Ireland really look more deeply at itself and respond to the real needs of the Irish that are living there. I think the property issue is one of them. I mean, I think the story of your young journalist is a great example. We should be able to accommodate people, you know, justly and fairly. And if we have open spaces and open properties that are not being used, let's look at what we can do for the good of society.
And we had a report out recently called the Grace Report, and it showed that the next generation of school principals in primary and secondary, and as you know, like 90% of the schools here are Catholic run, their level of belief is going to be quite low or non-existent, which will mean that the Catholic Church actually won't have a modus operandi to be in the schools if the principal and the teachers don't believe it and probably won't want to teach it. Would you have any suggestions for people in school trusts that would be looking at that now and saying, how do we pull this back from the brink? How do we train our teachers?
Yeah, I remember going to Mater Dei, actually, you know, back in the day. And we were discussing this. We could see this at Mater Dei even then, right? There was some serious discussion that was taking place very early on. I think, you know, there was a warning bell that was sounded maybe 25 years ago around this issue. That warning bell has now become, for some people, a death knell, and it shouldn't be. I think there's a huge opportunity to look afresh at Catholic schools in Ireland. I did read the report, and it's pretty somber. You know, we have Catholic schools to because we have a mission to educate, to uplift the dignity of the human person. And at the center of that is our faith. Now, people want to take faith out of that equation. Then you lose something I think that's very fundamental, right, to us as Catholics, which is the desire to educate all children. In the US, that is still there. Like, we have schools who are for the very, very, very poor that are run by the Catholic Church. But we also have an unusual situation where some have become private and only the very, very wealthy can go to them. That's a problem for us as a church. I believe education is one of the best ways to form young people for what's happening in the world today. And I think, you know, I know we're tiptoeing around faith and different things here, but Catholic schools are Catholic for a reason. And yes, we have a mission to welcome and educate all, but we have to look at why we're educating children and meet that challenge today. So, you know, I think trusts have to really engage with this issue very seriously. I think, you know, there's a growing movement of parents who want to reject faith, but still want to have confirmation and first communions for their children. And I think we need to look at that issue and really engage it. I think there are solutions that can be helpful in the US context and other countries around the world. But I also think that Ireland needs to really find a way that fits what's happening. You're becoming a more pluralist society, multifaceted. Immigration is bringing all kinds of opportunities, but also a lot of challenges in the system. And so the next, I think, 10 years are going to be really critical to navigate what it means to have a Catholic school today and how important it is to have faith at the center of that conversation.
When I was in LA and we met at Anaheim at the education conference, whenever I mentioned Ireland, and I don't want to come across like we're beating up on Ireland here, but that's what it's kind of pertinent to what we're talking about. I got a lot of priests when I mentioned Ireland to them in the church in Ireland. They kind of shook their heads, sadly, you know, kind of a bit bewildered by what was going on. And I did get the impression that Catholicism is. It's by no means perfect in the US, but it's certainly more upbeat over there. And is that because you've gone through secularization more than we have? Or what would your take on that be?
Yeah, you know, and it's something too, when I go out and I speak all over the place. And I mean, we met Gary at an event. It was packed, right? There's several hundred people there. But when people come up to you and they say, oh, I'm praying for the church in Ireland, it almost breaks your heart a little bit. You know, I left Ireland 20 something years ago, because I wanted to work in not just a Catholic school, but I wanted to work at a parish, and there really wasn't a place for me. And lay involvement in the church was not something at the time that was really understood well, and there was formation and training and education around. And so, you know, I came over to the US. I ended up becoming a diocesan director of 9 different offices, including like Catholic camp, campus ministry at several universities, a worship office, co-directed an office for priests. I mean, just really interesting. And I think, yes, you're characterizing something that is very true to the American people, which is this entrepreneurial, optimistic, generous nature, which is, oh, we don't have it. Well, we can start it. And you see that kind of, you know, on the, you know, the capitalist side with businesses and all kinds of things. But on the church side, you also see it too with creativity. And so one thing that's very interesting is when my sister came over here, my sister is, you know, a typical young adult, you know, went to Catholic school, grew up in a house where, you know, our parents went to mass on Sunday, but like we never prayed at meals. We never read the Bible or anything like that at home. Like they're totally just, you know, a typical experience. When she came over to America to visit me, I brought her to Mass with me. And she said to me, if I lived here, I would be part of this community. And I said, why? And she said, because there's actually things for me to be engaged with. Like, you know, you can do a fun run for charity for the school. You have Masses that that have different, you know, styles that I could fit in. so she was very attracted to what she saw here. You know, I don't even think of it, but I get in the car and I put on the Christian radio station, and you know, it's not music from the 40s and 50s. Like, it's very contemporary and upbeat. It's hip hop. My kids love it. And it's also got a positive message. So you can kind of live in the US in, I don't want to say a Christian bubble, but because that's the danger, right? But I think there is an upbeat, optimistic nature, you know, intrinsic to the life in the church. And I think part of that is because we are an immigrant community. We do hold on to a lot of values. Catholicism is our shared narrative. So if you're coming from Vietnam or you're coming from the Congo and you're coming into the US, the one thing that you can go to that's very similar or has a similar framework is the Catholic Church. And then when you come into that and you don't see yourself reflected in it, a lot of the immigrant community will say, well, what can we start? And it always starts with like a mom's group or a dad's group. Or, I mean, it's unbelievable the kind of things. When I was out in California in February after we met, Gary, I went to, I did a parish mission, which is 3 nights on a particular theme. And we did the theme of We Till the Earth. So it's kind of an eco-friendly theme for a parish mission, which is very different. But after the parish mission, I walked over to their coffee shop, and they have a coffee shop right at the parish. And there's teenagers and their kids, and you know, they've this great fair trade coffee, and we're eating. And then I go out, and there's a group who are raising funds to drill a well in Africa. Cross over to the other side. I mean, there's just such great creativity, and the church becomes sort of the community center for all of that activity. It would be great to put the Catholic Church and community life at the center of rural life today, rather than lamenting the post office is closing or we don't have anything for our seniors. How can our Catholic Church provide a space? You know, maybe open up the community center from 2 to 4 and have seniors come for tea. Like, there's always something we can do. And money isn't an issue. It's creativity and resources and willingness to do something about it, I think.
And when you say resources, everyone here says, oh, well, sure, we're running out of priests and the priests are run ragged, which they are. But what you're talking about isn't dependent solely on priests, right?
Oh, not at all. And, you know, I work with our priests, a lot of them, I love them, and they have their limitations. They'll tell you that too. You know, their job is to sanctify us in and through the liturgy and send us out into the world. Our job is to go out into the world to share our faith. So, you know, I work, I've been blessed to be able to work with a large number of priests who have a wonderful attitude when it comes to lay involvement in the church, which is, Julianne, what's your idea? Hey, working with dad's groups, whatever it is, they want to see lay involvement in the church. And so lay involvement in the church very much characterizes life in the US, because we don't have the priests either. You know, in the Diocese of Green Bay, Wisconsin, where I was diocesan director for 16 years, we have 156 parishes and we have about 90 priests. About 30 of those come from overseas, you know, the Philippines or India. And so we have a massive challenge on our hands as well. But what we do have is strong, committed lay volunteers and paid parish staff who are doing the most amazing creative work. And, you know, I mean, look at the mission that Jesus started. It was him and 12 lay people. And so from there, the church multiplied. And I think Ireland is going to have to really grapple with the challenge of lay-led ministry, not in competition with our priests, but in support of. And I think that can be a challenge sometimes for our priests, honestly, to figure out that balance. And so guidance is needed, but there's definitely, I mean, all the documents in the life of the church from Vatican II, pre-Vatican, all talk about the lay person, you and I, and our role in shaping the world and changing the life of the church. We have to get to grips with it.
And that's what Pope Francis has been kind of banging the drum on when he talks about that awkward word, synodality. Just and we'll finish on this, Julianne, but is just the whole idea of synod and synodality, which really is just people talking to each other and listening to each other, is that a thing at all in the States? Are people engaging with it as a concept?
It has become very polarizing, actually. It's kind of an interesting thing. And it isn't because of Pope Francis. Well, some of it may be connected to his person. You know, I listen for that too. One thing that is that I would caution the American church around, and I've said this publicly, is it can become very factionalized and tribal. And so, you know, you catch those sound bites and kind of very divisive statements on things. So yes, it's not a Catholic utopia over here, but synodality has become like that too. You know, there's some people who love it and some people who don't understand it at all and have no use for it. But at the core of it is, I love the idea that we're listening not just to each other, but we're trying to listen more attentively to the Holy Spirit and what the Holy Spirit is calling us to. Now, fascinating. A good friend of mine is one of the head theologians at the Synod in Rome. She's amazing. And she and I have had a lot of conversations about this. She's guiding some of the conversations around listening across the world, in fact. And she has talked to me several times about the Holy Father, Pope Francis's desire, that not just that we would be a church that listens more deeply to each other, but we would be a church that would listen more deeply to what the Holy Spirit is asking us to do and be, who we're called to be in the life of the world. And when you boil it down to its most simple essence, I think that is something that should connect us and bring us all together. So the Synod on Synodality, slightly controversial depending on who you're talking to, but actually a lot of our parishes in the US have really engaged with it, and they've engaged the issue of young people. They've used it as a way to really listen to what our young people are saying. And I think that's hugely important.
Absolutely. Julianne, we could talk to you all day. Maybe we could do this another time. But look, best of luck with your trip over to Ireland and your visit your dad and family and all that. The book's called The Catholic Parent Survival Guide by Julianne Stan, Straight Answers to Your Kids' Toughest Questions by Loyola Press, who you work for. And it's available on Amazon, I presume.
It is. You can get it on Amazon Small Books. If you're interested more in the kind of Celtic world, the Celtic spirituality world, I just want to put a nod in for my book, Braving the Thin Places. I've heard from a lot of people in Ireland that was hugely helpful for them in kind of bridging what they would have grown up with in the past with maybe where they are now in their lives. So, yeah, you can find them on Amazon.
That'll be another podcast or so. Okay.
That would be lovely. I'd love to come back.
Okay, great to see you. Thanks a million for joining us today.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Julianne.